Welcome to the Disney Parks Podcast with your hosts, Tony Castelnova from DisneyByTheNumbers.com and Krista Joy from DisneyWays.com. Keep your hands, arms, feet, and legs inside the podcast at all times and get ready for the Disney Parks Podcast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the show. Our special guest today is Disney designer and Imagineer Raleigh Crump. Now, Raleigh's Disney career spanned more than 40 years with a few interruptions. During those interruptions, he created his own companies and worked on projects around the world. And in 2004, Raleigh was honored with the Walt Disney Legends Award, which, of course, is a prestigious award that acknowledges those outstanding individuals who helped create the magic of Disney. For more on Raleigh, you can make sure to visit itskindofacutestory.com and pick up his books and audiobooks. And Tony's going to kick it off with the first question.
Hey, Raleigh, I think we want to start with how you got started with the Disney company. I think it was probably Imagineering and WED back then. But how did you get your start with Disney?
Okay. You want it from the beginning, don't you?
Sure. Let's get a little preview.
No problem. Well, you have to remember something. When I was born, I think there was a pencil in my hand because I had to start drawing immediately when I could hold a pencil. For some reason, I just loved to draw, and my mom was really sweet, always made sure I had pencils and a pad to draw on. And being born basically an artist, you just had to draw something every day. And this went on and on and on and all through school and everything. And then the next thing I can remember was seeing Disney cartoons. And I can remember my father took me to see the Three Little Pigs when they first came out, which I was probably 4 years old or thereabouts. And that absolutely turned me on to Disney. So, you know, following Disney all those years, I actually did draw some of the little Disney characters when I was a little guy, and just kept on and on and on. But, you know, I guess what happens is when you're an artist, your dream in those days was to work for Disney. That was just part of the program. So I always wanted to work for them, but I didn't have a clue. My mom sent a letter to Disney when I was 16. She says, my son is really talented. I want to know if we can get him a job working for your company. And I don't know who sent the answer back, but she was satisfied with whatever it was. Anyway, I went to a Christmas party that my mother's cousin had when I was 22 years old. And we were in, and my mom was talking about the fact that, you know, I love to draw and everything. Well, one of the ladies was had worked for Disney, and she said, "Well, I used to work in animation." And we said, "Wow!" And she said, "You want to know someone to call?" And I said, "Oh God, please, yes." So she gave me the name Andy Ingman and his phone number. So I called him. So I said, "Okay." So within the next two or three days, the Disney lot, which was absolutely a shock for me to think that I'm actually on the Disney lot, which was great. Anyway, we had a little session. He told me to bring my portfolio, which I did. And I guess the portfolio mainly was an awful lot of high school work because I had absolutely no formal training, which I had an interesting discussion with Walt about that at a later time frame. But so he says, yeah, let me look at it. So he looked at it. And of course, as the years, now I'm going to go fast forward for you for a minute. When I left animation and went into working for WED, I was called into the same office with Andy Ingman and one of the other gentlemen that was there. And they said, you know, you'd like to move to WED? And I said, I'd love to. And I said, when can I start? And they said, how about money? And I said, I'll take it. Well, then they said, you know, Raleigh, we want you to know that you had the worst portfolio of anyone that was ever hired at the Disney Studios. Wow. So anyway, that's how I got started with my worst portfolio. Wow. But anyway, they believed in me, and it was really sweet. So they hired me, and then they informed me what my salary was going to be. which was $30 a week. Well, I was working in a pottery. I was a dipper in a pottery, and I was making $75 a week. And I thought, I can't afford to go to work for Disney. It never dawned on me, you know, that they didn't pay that much to begin with. So I was concerned. I said, I'll get back with you. So they said, okay. So what I did was I went to my mom, you know, who's been my supporter all those years, and I told her, I said, you know, I can't afford to work for them for that. My mom says, you always want to work there, Rolly. It'll work out one way or another. So I said, okay, because she, you know, she told me there's no problem. it'll be taken care of. I said, okay. So I went and I said, yeah. I'll come to work for you. So within probably about, I'd say 3 or 4 weeks, I was hired and I was brought in, and they showed me how to do in-betweens and sent me off in a corner and let me draw in-betweens all day long. And evidently I did a good enough job because they said, okay, we'll hire you. So that's how I got started. That was in 1952 when I was 22. And I was thrilled. I was, you know, like I said, going onto the Disney lot was just an incredible experience.
Yeah.
That's how I got started, how I was invited to work there.
Awesome. And what was it like working for Walt the Man? How did you feel about that?
How about working
for Walt Disney?
Oh, God, I'm sorry. Well, I was thrilled, absolutely thrilled. I mean, he was my hero. You know, I used to see a lot of the they'd show film clips of he and his designers and artists, you know, when they flew down to Mexico to do the beautiful little cartoons that they were working on and you know, Saludos Amigos. And, basically, it was a thrill. Now, you have to understand something. I never knew him until I started working for WED. So I actually worked for him for 9 years. And it was interesting because everybody that worked at the studio felt they were working for Walt. They felt that, you know, he was who they were working for. So they didn't think anything about it. You never paid any attention to the people you were answering to because you felt you were working for Walt. And it was just great. And then I was invited to go to work at WED. And that was the first time I met Walt. And so I walked up to him, and he was standing there to meet me. And I shook his hand and I said, Mr. Disney, it's a pleasure to work for you. And he says, Rolly, he says, it's, or he called me Roland then, it wasn't Rolly. He said, it's great to have you on board. And I said, thank you, Mr. Disney. And that's when he said, no, the name is Walt, and don't you ever forget it. Everything was on a first name basis with him, which was absolutely incredible.
Yeah, wow. That sounds great. So when you went to WED, what were some of the first things that you worked on?
Well, actually, when I first went over there, see, the interesting thing about it, they hired me, but they didn't know what they were going to do with me. And I think the reason was that they had seen the little propeller and mobile exhibit I had in the library at the studio. And they said, well, the kid's got some imagination. Let's hire him. I think that was the bottom line. So they didn't know what to do with me. They really didn't. And because of the propellers that I did that ran off the air conditioning, the first thing I was invited to work on, Claude Coates was doing backgrounds for, there was the Alice in Wonderland ride. And also he was doing another ride, you know, it was the Alice ride. And he wanted a field of flowers that were propellers. So my first assignment was to make propellers for a field of flowers, which was kind of crazy. But I did whatever they asked me to do. And the next thing I know, we started working on the Tiki Room a little bit. And Walt asked me to design some of the birds that would be in the Tiki Room. And so I said, okay, well, I got some styrofoam out, and I started carving little birds and filling them up, you know, loading them up with all kinds of feathers and everything. And the problem was I didn't know what I was doing, but I was having a good time. And Walt just wanted to look at me. He said, well, you know, I think we want to have the birds in the Tiki Room look like real birds. He says, Rolly, do you mind? And I said, no, that's quite all right with me.
Did you save one of the birds you made, though?
Did you save one of the birds?
I took a bunch of them home and had them hanging in my house. And when I did the interior for the bazaar in Adventureland, I hung a lot of them there. So I had done about a dozen of them. They were really cute, but I can understand what Walt was trying to do with that show. You know, the old man always knew what he was doing, and he had what was interesting about Walt was that when he decided to do a project, especially for Disneyland, he actually saw it finished in his head. And so as you were working on it, he just kind of coached you along, and pretty soon it would turn out exactly the way he wanted, which is incredible.
Yeah, I think he had a very good knack for picking the right person for the right job.
Yeah. Well, he was the best casting director.
Yeah.
A good example is he had Mark and Claude working in animation, and then Mark did the animation of the characters, and Claude did the background. Well, that's what happens at Disneyland. I mean, a good example is the pirate ride. Claude did all the backgrounds of the pirate ride, and Mark did all the pirates.
Yeah. I know, Wally, you had some influence on some of the things that were done at the World's Fair. Can you tell us what you did for the 1964 New York World's Fair?
Yeah. Well, what happened was it all started with Walt. We didn't know this. Somewhere along the line, the fair contacted Walt and wanted to get the Disney organization involved with him. So the next thing we know, we're designing a pavilion for the Ford Company for the World's Fair. And we didn't have a clue that Walt had decided to do all this for them. I mean, it never trickled down to us. We were the model shop, so we didn't really know what was going on. So I remember we had work sessions with Walt about the different parts of the Ford Pavilion. And the first assignment that I got was doing a ramp show. And what it was like I was designing window displays. You went up the ramp, and on the ramp in the different locations, there were all the stories of all the different little Model A's, the Model T's, and the evolution of the growth of these cars. So that was a lot of fun. I had a good time, you know, doing window display with that, only it was full size. And then the next thing I know, we had a meeting with Walt, and Walt says, you know, the one thing I always want to do is when people are standing in line, I want to entertain them. So he said, you know, and he turned to me, he says, Rolly, I want you to design a little orchestra. So when people are standing in line to get in the car, there's a little orchestra playing and they can see that. So I did some real crazy kind of funky sketches and stuff and showed them to him. And then he started talking. This is where Walt would step in and actually get you going in the right direction. He said, you know, Rolly, those are okay. He said, but you know what? He said, why don't you design a little orchestra that's made out of automobile parts? So I said, oh, okay, we can do that. So I got a hold of Bob Gurr, and we got a book from Ford of all of the different automobile parts to put in a car. And so Gurr and I sat down for a week and started dismantling some of the pieces of the car. A good example, we used the hubcaps as cymbals for the orchestra. We had a great big crank that was part of the structure of the frame, and we used that as their big bass vial. So we started actually repositioning different parts and cutting them apart and everything. And so we actually built a model on it. And we showed it to Walt, and he said, great. And so we had all these little car parts put together, and they looked like instruments. They really did. I actually have photographs of them from the fair, and I thought, gee, they turned out really good. Now, realizing what you're doing, but getting direction from the right man.
We had this event here in Florida, this Destination D, and they kind of took us through the World's Fair. And one of the things they showed us was the Tower of the Four Winds.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you came up with that design?
Yes, of course. You have to understand that I started making propellers when I was in animation. one of the fellows had made a propeller, and he had it on his desk, and it was spinning, and he had it on top of a little lamp. And I went to Wathel. I said, "Wathel, that's great. How did you do that?" And he says, "I can't tell you. It's a secret." And he was driving me crazy because every time I go in there, now the propeller was made out of a clip that holds an eraser in a pencil. And so he had taken that. So I went back and I tried making, you know, pulling clips out of my erasers and trying to make, you know, putting dents in it with a nail and everything, trying to make a propeller, and I couldn't make it. So after about 3 or 4 weeks, I drove him crazy. I said, "Wait, I've got to know." He said, "I can't tell you," but he says, "I'll sell it to you." So I said, "I'll buy it." I said, "How much?" He says, "A penny." So he sold me my first propeller for a penny. And then he explained to me how to do it. You use a ballpoint pen to make the dent, and that meant it's a perfectly smooth little dent. See, when you use a nail, it's crooked. It's all kind of meshed in there. Mm-hmm. So it would ride on that. So anyway, I was really proud of my little propeller I had that I bought, and I made a cardboard helicopter, and I put the propeller on that. And actually, if you held it close to the wall in animation, we had good air conditioning, the little propeller would really spin. So I had this little guy up there, and I was really proud of him, this little helicopter. Well, one of the kids came in from the art department and said, "God, that's really neat, Roy." He said, "How'd you do that?" I said, "I won't sell it to you. I'll tell you how I did it." So I showed him how to do it. He went back to his office, and a few days later, he called me in and showed me that he had made a propeller, but he'd added some little nice cardboard discs on the each end of the propeller. So his propeller was bigger than mine. Well, I was quite disturbed about that. So I went back to my office, and for the next month or two, in my spare breaks and before in the mornings when I first got there and stayed after work, I started making propellers. And so I had probably 30 different structures in my office with all these propellers spinning on them. And there's probably a good 30 propellers going at that time. And I was having a great time. Well, that's when the fellow T.E. that I worked with said, "You know, you should have an exhibit at the library, because at the library you could have exhibits of your artwork or whatever." So I signed up for it, and I had all my propellers, and I get a call from the librarian. She says, "Walt was down and saw your exhibit." And I says, "Oh my God." I said, "Did he like it?" She says, "Yes, he really thoroughly enjoyed it." Well, Walt never forgot the propellers because he was absolutely intrigued by them, and that's how I got hired. And of course, this was long before I'd ever met him when I did the propellers. So then when it came time for the World's Fair of Small World, Walt came to me and says, "Roly, I want you to do me a tower of propellers." He says, "We'll call it the Tower of the Four Winds." So I made a little model, showed it to him. He said, "That's great. Now," he said, "I want you to make a model that really works." So I did a half-inch scale model of the Tower of the Four Winds, and with all these propellers all over it, and that's the one that I'm on TV with him on.
Wow.
So that's how it all started, with my little propellers and Walt falling in love with them and then doing the tower. Now, the story behind the tower is kind of interesting because the model I built was very delicate. And when the engineers got a hold of it to build the real one, and because of the wind loads, they had to really make everything fat. So a lot of the pipes were 6 inches, became 16 inches. The main pipe that went up to the cent almost became 2 feet. And to me, it became very awkward and very cumbersome, and I didn't like it at all, the finished one that they were building. So I was really upset about it. Anyway, they finished the tower. It was in L.A., and I had to drive Walt down to take a look at it on a buy-off. So I took Walt down, and we're standing there looking at it, and he says, "Roly, what do you think of it?" And I said, "I think it's a piece of crap." Now, I don't think many people would say to Walt, "I think it's a piece of crap," but that was just, I don't know, I was very free with him with the way we talked. And he said, Roland, he says, it can't be a piece of crap. It cost me $200,000. And I said, well, you know how I feel about it. I said, it lost its delicacy. And he said, well, when you work with engineers, you know, they have to worry about the wind loads in New York. And he says, of course, you know, can be kind of, they have hurricanes up there. So he said, you know, they had to do that. And I said, okay. So anyway, he turned to me, he said, well, I love it. And I said, okay, good. Well, then I said, give me some time and maybe I'll love it too. Well, by the time we got it to the World's Fair, and I was back at the fair installing Small World, and I went around and looked at it every day. Well, then I fell in love with it. So it was a love.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
You know, we heard that it could be seen from like almost anywhere in the World's Fair. So it was, I think, the thing that maybe drew people to the Disney Pavilion.
And he said they heard that they could see it. You could see it from anywhere.
Oh, yes, yes, yeah.
Yeah, it would draw people to the pavilion.
Yeah. Well, it was a marquee. Yeah. And Walt knew that because it really was gorgeous. I mean, when those propellers were spinning, the whole thing came to life, and it was just beautiful. It really was.
So how did we end up with a clock tower for It's a Small World at Disneyland?
Well, that's an interesting question, too. Walt asked me to design. I mean, I designed the facade for the Small World coming back from the World's Fair, and the facade is 300 feet long, and I used all of Mary Blair's styling to do that with. And there was a platform right in the center where the boats went into the ride, and so it was a little kind of a platform there. And Walt asked me, "So what are you going to put there?" And I said, "I don't know." He said, well, you got to have something there, Roly. And I said, yeah. I said, maybe we could make a little bandstand out of it and we could have orchestras play there. So when people are going on the ride, there's a little, no, Walt says, we're not doing that. No bandstand up there. He says, why don't you put a clock there? Now, this is where he is so damn important because he'll make a little tiny suggestion and then it always turns out to be bigger than life. So I said, okay. So I got a hold of Yale Gracie, and I built a little model of a clock using Mary's style, and Yale took and put a little clock motors on it, and actually a little thing actually animated. And so Walt came over, took one look at it, he says, great. He says, we'll have a clock there. And he says, it looks good. And I said, good. He says, okay. Now, he said, I want you to build a larger scale, one that actually animates just like the real clock will animate. Now, you have to remember that Walt had us design everything in models. He felt that if he could see a model on it, it was scale, he'd really understand it. And he one time said, you know, renderings can lie to you. He said, but models don't. So I built a little model. I built a half-inch scale model of that clock, and it actually had all the sound effects in it. It had all the music in it, and I had eight little characters come out of the back side of it and going around and go in the other side, and the doors would open up, and little trumpeters would blow their horns and everything, and then the main door would open up, and it would be the clock to show the time. Well, he loved it. He just absolutely loved it. And he said, you know, Roland, he said, I don't think we should have the characters come out of the side of the clock. And I said, oh, okay, sir. He said, no. He said, we should have them come out of the front of the clock and go around and go to the back. I said, okay. Now, he said, you know how many hours are in a day? And I said, 24. And he said, yep. He said, we want 24 characters coming out.
So
that's why there's 24 characters coming out of there, because that's what Walt wanted. I mean, he would always just, you know what, the sweetheart would just take you to the next level or to the next level and constantly, you know, take you to the next level. And then I learned that the best thing for me to do was show him something he'd never seen before. And so that would take it up to the next level.
Wow, that is great. It's a Small World in Disneyland is a lot different than It's a Small World in Florida. And I really like the one in California a lot better. It really means that, you know, you've arrived. You can see this great, you know, attraction. And it really lights up and does a lot of great things. And that clock tower is probably one of my favorite things on that attraction.
Well, you know what happened, and of course this gets with management. We actually designed a much larger Small World out front to when you went in, and also It was exact copy of the one we had at Disneyland. Well, Dick Irvine called me in one day, and they'd run out of money. And so he says, you know, you have to take 200 feet out of the ride. And I said, what? So I had to remove 200 feet from that ride. So it's a much smaller ride at the World's Fair. I mean, excuse me, at Disney World. But the one thing I did do was I put water to the sets. So you got a better reflection on the water. Because the one at Disneyland, you can look down and you can see the cords from the electrical lines and everything. So I feel that the bottom line was with the water in there, it was a better, and I think the finale, of course, is a lot better because of the reflection of all the little twink lights that we have there. But it was part of management, the things that you have to go through.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I was reading that you did some of the design work for the Haunted Mansion. Can you tell us like what you did, and then where you got like the inspiration to do some of the designs for the Haunted Mansion?
Yeah, it's Yale and I were put together to begin with. Well, that was another one of the first things I was asked to do when I went to WED, and because Walt wanted us to work on, he knew he was going to do a mansion. He didn't know when, but he knew he wanted to do one. So they put Yale and I together, and we worked for a solid year coming up with all kinds of illusions to put in there. And what we did was a lot of the other people in animation had done all kinds of sketches of what the Haunted Mansion would be like. So Yale and I had a whole stack of drawings of everything, and an awful lot of it was almost like they were out of a cartoon. It wasn't for real or anything. And I always felt when Yale and I were working together that it should be kind of surrealistic. It should, the rooms should come alive and talk to you, and you're in a room that is something that is sort of, like I said, it was just weird. So I was always feeling that we should do in that direction, but I never had a chance to do much of that in the early days because we were doing mock-ups, full-scale mock-ups to show Walt the illusions that we were doing and the head and the ball and everything. So we really, Yale was the secret really to the Haunted Mansion because it was his illusions that made the mansion what it is. Without Yale's illusions, the mansion would be a zip. It wouldn't have any life to it at all. So we all went off and did the fair, and then when we came back from the fair, Walt wasn't coming over and giving us new assignments yet. So I thought, well, I guess I'll work on the Haunted Mansion again. So then there's a film that I had seen, Beauty and the Beast, that I saw that was actually produced in 1946, a French film. And it was Beauty and the Beast. And in there, the beast lived in a gigantic castle. And when you come into the castle and he'd walk down the hallways, all these human arms would holding torches that would lead the way. Then when he got into his main salon, you'd see that there were human heads sculpted on the wall. And the human heads would look at each other, and then they would have steam or smoke, green smoke coming out of their mouths. And on the table, there was a bowl of grapes, and there was an arm holding that. And when the beast would reach for a grape, the arm would extend the grapes to him. And I thought, that's what it should be. We need more kind of surrealistic things in the mansion to make it different, because we don't want to just do another, you know, eyes on the in the painting watching you go by. No, I didn't think that was good. So I started working on all these crazy little sketches that I did. I had a candle man. I had a chair that stood up and talked to you. I did a coffin clock. It was like a grandfather's clock, but it was a coffin. And so I did all these little crazy sketches. Meanwhile, because I'd started drawing stuff for the Haunted Mansion, Dick Irvine, that was in charge there, he said, well, you know, we ought to put a lot of guys on the mansion again. And so he did. He put all these other designers on the mansion. And he said, we'll have a presentation to Walt and show him the direction we think we might be taking him. So I said, great. So one fellow that I worked with, Jack Furgis, actually built a model of everything that I had sketched. But the problem was Dick Irvine and some of the other guys said, you know, Rolly, that stuff is too weird. You know, that's weird stuff. You know, we're not going to put that in the mansion. And they said, Walt's not going to like it. And I said, well, I don't know. I said, I still think there's something that should be in there like that. So the next day, I was allowed to take my little table in there with all my models on it and my sketches and everything, and they put it in the back of the room. So when Walt came in and sat down at a table, his chair was facing the other end of the room. And so the other guys got up and gave their presentation, and that was it. And Walt turned to Dick Irvine. He says, is that it? And Dick said, yes. And he said, well, what's this stuff in the corner behind me? And they said, well, that's some stuff that Rolly did. And he said, well, what is it? And they said, we don't know. You ask him. So Walt turned to me and said, Rolly, what is it? And I said, I don't know. So he and I both took our chairs and we rolled them over to where all my sketches were and the model and everything. He said, how do you want to use that? And I said, I don't know. I said, I just think we need some serialistic stuff in the mansion. And I said, you know, I don't want to just get back to the way mansions are supposed to, all the scary stuff is supposed to look like. So he said, yeah, but how are you going to use it? I don't know. So we went back and forth. As I don't know. I don't know. I don't. So he finally said, okay, I'm out of here. So he got up and he walked out of the meeting. And that meeting had been about for 4 hours. So they all kind of looked at me and said, you know, Rolly, we told you that he wouldn't like your stuff. It was too weird. And I said, yeah, but I said, I still think there's a place for it. I came to work the next morning and I go to my desk at 7 o'clock and Walt Disney is sitting in my chair and he's looking up at me and I said, good morning. And he says, you son of a bitch. And I said, well, what? And he said, I didn't get an ounce of sleep last night because of all those weird pictures you showed me yesterday. And I looked down and he was still dressed in the same clothes he had on the day before. And I said, I guess he's telling me the truth. So he said, you know, I think I know what we can do with it. I said, you do? He said, yes. He said, what we're going to do is when you leave the mansion, you can go into a museum, and it's going to be called the Museum of the Weird. And he said, and then you can put all the weird stuff that you want to put in there, Rolly. He says, you can do whatever you want, and we're going to tell the public when they come that we've collected the weirdest things that we could from all over the world, and we now have them at Disneyland. And I said, I told him, shit, well, that's pretty damn good. So he said, I think so, too. So then he had Dick Irvine bring the other guys in. All the guys are in the meeting. So they came to my desk, and he gives them a 25-minute presentation on what the Museum of the Weird is going to be. And then he gets up and he says, now I'm going to go home and go to bed. And he walked away. And as he walked away, they all came up to me. And they put their hands on my shoulders. And they said, you know, Rolly, we really knew you had something there.
Of course.
So let me tell you something. I had an insight on all those mothers that I worked with. I knew what they were really like. You know, they were scared to death of Walt for some unknown reason. And that's not fair. He was just a sweetheart of a guy to work with. And I always took advantage of the fact that I felt that I was close to him. And he, in turn, felt he was close to me. And whenever he'd come in for a meeting, I'd always go and sit next to him. And whenever the meeting was over with, if there was something about the meeting that took place that I didn't quite understand, I said, Walt, excuse me, sir. You know, I said, but there was that one little discussion that we had, and I'm not quite sure where we were going with that. And he turned to me and said, well, now, Roland, this is what we're going to do. He said, I think we should do this, 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 and this. Or he'd say, Roly, shit, I don't know. So anyway, there was this little conversation that Roly had with Walt were very special. Now, there is another kind of a special little story about him. When I was in animation, I painted on rocks. A lot of us in animation painted rocks, faces and stuff. And the nurse, Hazel George, came to me because she knew I painted on rocks. And she said, I want you to paint a rock for me. I want to give it to Walt for Christmas. And I said, you do? And she said, yes. And so I said, what do you want me to paint on the rock? She said, I want you to paint the word shit. I said, what? She said, that's his favorite cuss word. I said, oh, okay. So I painted this little rock with the name shit on, with shit on it, put it in a beautiful little Japanese box, and gave it to her, and she in turn gave it to Walt for a Christmas present. Now, this was long before I ever met him. This was probably 6 years before I was asked to go to WED. And so I saw her about a week later. I said, Hazel, I said, did Walt enjoy his gift? She said, he loved it. And she said, by the way, you got screen credit. But golly knows if you knew who Rory was in those days.
I also read that you had done some designs for the Tiki Room. You had mentioned that you were doing the birds. You know, when Walt said to do that kind of stuff, did he give you some kind of point of reference to kind of draw your inspiration from?
Well, he'd give you an assignment, and he'd give you an assignment you'd never done before. And this, again, got back to being that it was going to be a restaurant. The Tiki Room originally was going to be a restaurant. And so I said, you know, Rolly, he says, when people are waiting in line out front there, he said, we've got to entertain them. So he said, why don't you design some tikis that can talk to the public and tell stories while they're waiting for dinner or whatever? And I said, oh, okay. So I went to John Hinch. I said, Jesus Christ, John, what do I do? And he says, you go to the library and you get a book out on the tikis of the islands and find out who the hell they are and what they do, everything. So I did. I found this beautiful book. I found I actually got it from UCLA. And what it was missionaries had written a book called Whispers on the Wind. And there had been some missionaries living with the islanders way, way back. And they learned what all the myths and legends were. So as I went through the book, it was great. There was all these different names of these different tikis. There was Hina, there was Longo, there was Maui. There was all these different names. But underneath them was what they were the god of. Now, Rongo was the god of agriculture. So I actually designed a tiki with a bowl of fruit on his head. And then there was another god that it was a god of the east wind, and then the god of rain. And so there were all these gods. So I did all these sketches of what the gods would, you know, the different stories behind them, with the idea that they would talk to the audience about why they were a god. And then the cute story is, the god Rongo was the god of agriculture, but he was also the god of kite flying. And the reason for that, and this is a true story, the god of the east wind challenged him, Rongo, to a kite flying contest because he wanted to be the god of kite flying. This god, and so Rongo said, "Okay, well, as it turned out, they had a kite flying contest, but Rongo won, and the reason Rongo won was because he had longer string." So that's the story of Rongo being the god of agriculture as well as the god of kite flying. Well, the piece of sculpture I eventually did was him with a bowl of fruit on his head. In his hand, he's flying a kite. So it was just marvelous. I mean, Walt always made you climb inside areas that you'd never done before. Now, one of the better ones about the pre-show tikis was I'd sketched one that was not a tiki, but it was a god. I mean, it was a tiki. He wasn't a god, excuse me. He was a tiki spitting water into a bamboo tube, and when the tube filled, it would dump the water, and then it would come back and hit another little god on the head. But I just thought it was a fun little sketch to do. But it wasn't a god, and I hadn't made it up or anything. I just did that. So Walt's looking at all the tikis. He says, "Rolly," he said, "what's this a god of?" And I just went dead. And luckily, John Hinch was standing there, and he turned to Walt and he said, "Walt, it's a god of tampa cloth beating." And Walt misunderstood him, and he thought he said clock rather than cloth. And Walt said to John, he says, what kind of a clock? He says, it's a god that tells the time. And Walt says, oh, okay. So after the meeting was over, Hitch said, Rolly, you better go find out who the hell the god is that tells time, and then scalped him. So I did, and it turns out it was Maui. So that's how Maui got designed and sculpted.
That's great. I read, you know, once they started you know, with the Disneyland project, and we're moving towards the Florida project and Walt Disney World. What involvement did you have with the designs of Walt Disney World, Raleigh?
For the
designs at Walt Disney World?
I didn't have anything to do with that. They just re-sculpted everything we had done for Disneyland.
Really?
So I was not involved with the Tiki Room at all.
Not the Tiki Room, in general.
In general?
Not the Tiki Room.
Oh, in general? Oh, and well, in general, I did the Magic Shop, and I did Small World, and I did the Toad Ride. Those are the three things I did for general.
Okay, good.
Wow. And you left Disney for a while, and then you came back to work at Epcot, right? And what did you work on at Epcot?
Well, I was in charge of the Land Pavilion. I was also in charge of the Life Health Pavilion to begin with, and they didn't get a sponsorship for that, so we never built that one. But Kraft came in and said, if you build a pavilion about food, he says, we'll sponsor it. Now, the sponsors had to put in $60 million, and because Disney would duplicate it. They would pay 60, and the sponsor would pay 60, and that's how they could afford to build those pavilions. So I was put in charge of the Land Pavilion. It's the largest pavilion in Epcot. It's five acres under roof, and it was a delightful time. I had an incredible team of designers working with me, which made it, you know, well, I love teamwork. So, and that's something I learned from Walt, you know. He always called all these designers my guys. And so that's the way I felt about it, that we should always have, you know, and I always mixed as many women designers in what I was doing as men, because I felt that it should be evenly balanced.
We had spoke to a friend of yours, Bob, and we were talking about your windows on Main Street. Can you tell us a little bit about your window on Main Street?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I have one sitting right here where I'm sitting. They gave me a duplicate, and which is great. The interesting thing about that is that, as it says, the palm reader assistant. Mm-hmm. And the reason that they said assistant was John Hinch was the palm reader. And because John taught me when I started working for WED, I didn't know what I was doing, and I could always go to John, and John would help me out and give me direction. So he was my mentor. So that because of that, then I became a palm assistant.
I love it.
But also, your window and Bob's window are the only two windows that have a three-dimensional feature to them, correct?
Your window and Bob's are the only windows that have a three-dimensional feature to them. I think that's the thing that hangs over.
Oh, yeah. You're right. There was there's three different pieces, isn't there? Or is there just two? Just two, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know anything about that. I don't know how that
Well, Bob told us he was the first one to get something three-dimensional, and then you got something. So
Bob said he was the first one to get something three-dimensional, and then you got one.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You're talking about Bob Gurr.
Yes.
Yeah. You know what Bob did? This is incredible. And I still have it. He did a video of me getting my award, getting my window. I mean, it's the most beautiful video going. I mean, he just stood back there and took shots of everything while they were doing it. And in there, there was a gag that they pulled when I was getting the window. The mayor was, you know, presenting the award to me, but all of a sudden he's got a phone on his desk, and the phone rings. Now, we're outside out on Main Street, and there's a phone, an old-time phone there that rings. Well, what it was the other gentleman that I was sharing, he was getting a window at the same time that I was sharing with, had passed away. And what happened was, when the phone rang, it was him. he was calling from heaven and telling me that he was up there and that he was with Walt and that they were really thrilled about me getting a window. And I'm going, oh, my God, what the hell's going on here? And he says, you know, we're thinking about having you come up and redesign the pearly gates. And so I turned to him. I said, well, when do you want me to be up there? And that kind of cracked everybody up. And he says, you know, well, there's no hurry, Rolly. You know, when the time comes. Don Edgren was the gentleman's name. And the reason that they played that gag on me was that Don Edgren did that at the when John Hinch passed away. We all went, there was, God, I don't know, went over to a theater in Glendale for services for John. And Don Edgren was the one on the up there announcing everything and introducing different people. And then that's when the phone rang, but he reached into his coat pocket and took an old-time phone out, and he was talking to Hinch on the phone. And he was asking John how it was going, and John told him, and he says, is Walt up there? And Hinch says, oh, yeah. He said, Walt says his best to everybody. So this was a gag that Don Edgren had pulled, you know, for John Hinch. Well, what happened was that's why the mayor decided to pull that gag with me, because Don Edgren had passed away.
Wow. Oh, wow. Well, I just want to thank you so much for your time. And also, we want to let everybody know that you are online. So you have rollandcrump.com, which is fascinating and wonderful. And then you also have several editions of books and audiobooks that you did with Jeff Heimbuch, who we've had on the show several times. So we want everybody to know about those so they can go buy them online and all that good stuff.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's our pleasure. So did you enjoy doing all of those? And do you think there's going to be more Rolly Crump products coming out?
Anything else coming out of yours?
No, not right away.
Taking a break?
It's all in my head.
Okay. All right. Well, sounds good. Well, don't hang up, but we're going to wrap up the show. So we would just want to thank everybody for tuning in, and we'll see you in the parks.
Thank you.
The Disney Parks Podcast is not affiliated with the Walt Disney Company. All Disney parks, attractions, lands, shows, event names, etc. are registered trademarks of the Walt Disney Company.
Like a boat out of the blue, fate steps in and sees you through one reach upon the stars.